Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story. This week on On Story, we're diving behind the pages of the 1999 classic horror film, The Blair Witch Project, with screenwriter Daniel Myrick and his wife and research partner, Julia Myrick. Daniel Myrick is a director and screenwriter most known for co-directing and writing the 1999 psychological horror film, The Blair Witch Project, with Eduardo Sanchez. Considered a seminal work in low-budget filmmaking, as well as being one of the highest-grossing films in history, the film ushered in a new methodology of production and grassroots marketing that is still being utilized today. He later went on to pen the screenplays for Believers, which he co-wrote with his now wife, Julia Myrick, Solstice, The Objective, and the 2020 sci-fi found footage horror film, Skyman. Moderator Rob Gonzalez spoke with Dan and Julia at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Blair Witch Project, courtesy of Haxan Films, Inc.
How are you feeling about with building a modern myth and museum pieces and what your plan was for the film before the premiere and then after the premiere? Because Blair Witch caught like a fever.
Yeah, well, back in the early days, Eduardo Sanchez, the co-director and co-writer with me on it, it started out pretty organically. I mean, both Ed and I wanted to make something that was genuinely scary. We're sort of like, we grew up on, I don't know how many of you remember, like the old In Search Of episodes back in the day with Leonard Nimoy and you know, Ancient Astronauts. And we just loved that sort of pseudo-documentary format. And we thought it would be a good sort of aesthetic to kind of apply to a horror movie. And so we applied that to Blair Witch. And when you sort of take that approach, you sort of have to build this like backstory. Like if you're going to come at it with like a realistic or authentic conceit, what is it rooted in? What is this kind of premise rooted in? So, you know, we started thinking, okay, you have these three filmmakers that go into the woods. They're doing this movie about the Blair Witch Project. Well, what is the Blair Witch? What does that all mean? So we had to pull from folklore in the local area up there in Northern Maryland, Civil War folklore, witchcraft back in that area. So we pulled a little bit from all those different sort of backgrounds and sort of formulated our own sort of base, you know, Ellie Kedward story of what the Blair Witch was rooted in. So our documentary would have sort of a context. So from there it grew as the audience sort of, or our initial core audience sort of dialed into what we were doing online. They kept asking us questions about, well, what happened before this? And back in this day and that, what happened? So we had to kind of keep up and scale up as they kept asking us questions. So the mythology grew as the audience was growing.
It is a small, quiet Maryland town, much like a small, quiet town anywhere. No more than 20 families laid their roots here over 200 years ago, many of whom remain either on this hill or in the town below. There are an unusually high number of children laid to rest here, most of whom passed in the 1940s. Yet no one in the town seems to recall anything unusual about this time, to us anyway. Yet legend tells a different story, one whose evidence is all around us. Etched in stone.
And as by the time we were releasing the movie, we had really fleshed out a lot of that backstory with the help of Julia and Ben Rock, our production designer on it, and Christian de Guevara, who's also one of the writers on the original mythology, and Greg Hale also helped out a lot. So it was a real collaborative effort, but that whole universe building came as we were kind of fleshing out that original premise in the very early stages.
You mentioned looking at a lot of folklore. What were your research avenues for that, to look into something to take bits and pieces and create from?
Well, I mean, originally we wanted a certain sort of like aesthetic and tone. And a lot of it, I mean, if you look into like historical records or like American, in particular up in the Northeast, when you're talking about Civil War history and like the Salem witch trials and all that, we wanted things that felt that like that. We wanted a kind of a backstory that kind of played into that aesthetic and wasn't too far afield from what you've already heard. So when you heard about the Blair Witch mythology, you could almost fool yourself into thinking, oh, I've heard this before. This is something rooted in some folklore I've heard in the Northeast or in, you know, Massachusetts or, you know, wherever. So we did, you know, a fair amount of research into actual folklore in the area. I know Christian did and Ben did. And they came up with sort of hybrids of those old stories and made it our own. We really had to get serious about really fleshing it out. And when the Sci-Fi Channel came on board and said, hey, you guys should do a complimentary show for the movie itself, then we really had to get serious about doing interviews with experts and talking head interviews. And so it forced us to really think through that process in greater detail.
Sir Rustin Parr was hanged in, and he was hanged at a time when we didn't do hangings anymore. So I went to a bunch of old records. So we had a lot of very granular data of exactly where you would find these records. And I don't know how many of you have heard of The 13th Warrior. It's a movie about, Beowulf. And there was a guy from Arabia, and the guy that wrote that said he fabricated a bunch of backstory for that. And then he would look at his resources and he would fool himself. He spent a lot of time trying to look it up. And I had done the same thing. I was like, I'm going to be really careful that people can only go one layer in and immediately should realize this isn't true. Because we weren't trying to waste people's time. It's just enough that you want to believe Bloody Mary's in the mirror. Just enough for that. And then a few steps beyond, you don't want to scare people.
Yeah, our intention was never to pull a hoax. Our intention was also always to make it sort of feel real.
War of the world.
But even back then, people were very self-selective. They would not look at what they didn't want to know.
Right.
And then we had a great fabrication, Christian helped out with it, where we said, okay, here's an original 1970s. There's a 1970s cult. They had a book. It was at the Maryland Historical Society. We had a picture of it, said it was the Maryland Historical Society. And people started harassing the Maryland Historical Society to see it. And they're like, we don't have it. It's not real. They made up the whole thing. And they're like, oh, you don't want us to see it.
Yeah,
you're keeping it from us.
I had a cop from Albany call me at our crappy little office in Orlando, Florida, and said, you know, I've been spending months researching these three missing students in that area, and I'm on the phone, like I'm freaking out, and I haven't heard of this case. I've called all my, I think he was like a retired officer. I've called all my friends in the police department, and no one knows about it. And I just stopped a mid-sentence and said, this is all fake. And like, please don't arrest us. And then he just stopped and laughed. He goes, oh my God, this is great. I love it. You know? So if you need any help, let me know, you know? So he was all in, but.
But that touches on the next level. So you had people who didn't want to believe, right? That you would tell them, I'm going to tell you the truth, and they would be upset with you. And then they would tell you that you were wrong. And they would tell you, you're just trying not to tell me the truth because you're afraid of being sued. You know, it's just all liability. And then the second level was once people realized it wasn't true, they wanted to play along. So it was a really unique experience with the press.
Yeah, it was sort of like the Crying Game back in the day where no one let the ending of it. And for us, the early press, when, you know, that was one of our kind of internal decisions at Haxton, which was our production company at the time. Like, yeah, we let them in on it. We don't try to pull the wool over the press's eyes. And when they felt like they were sort of on the inside, and they knew that it was all, you know, just a narrative, then they tended to be a little bit more forgiving, I think, on the reviews.
And joyful.
And joyful about it, because it was something different. It was something kind of unique and new, and they got to kind of spring it on everybody later on.
All right. So I'm curious, with just the design of Blair Witch, of how you based it in kind of these faux documentary feelings, and with the mythology you built into it, what did the script look like originally?
Well, the script was pretty detailed. I mean, it was basically, if you imagine a traditional script just without the dialogue, because Ed and I, you know, we wanted the dialogue to be improvised, because what we were trying to avoid, in theory, was anything feeling like it was read or memorized or contrived. So basically, we spent many weeks outlining beat for beat what the actors were going to do from, you know, actually from 1 hour to the next, from one scene to the next. And what the point of every scene was going to be and what where they were going to go. And like, for example, at the cemetery in Burkittsville, you know, pretty much exactly what Heather was going to do and the gist of what she was going to say. But and then once we got out into the woods, it was a little bit more free form because we wanted them to have the freedom to be in character and sort of spontaneously, you know, burst into discussion when they saw fit. And an example, I mean, the way we set it up logistically is that we went out for like a month in advance and we had GPS systems where we could mark waypoints in the woods. So the
early days of GPS too.
Yeah, this is back before everyone had cell phones. So so they'd have a milk crate, you know, with a bicycle flag at the location where the waypoint was. So when the actors, you know, navigated to the woods, they'd come to the milk crate, they'd know where they were at their campsite. So that's where they were told to pitch their tent. And in the crate would be, you know, power bars and more food and, you know, batteries for the camera. And they were told to kind of put their spent tapes in there. So we'd review those tapes. But there was also directing notes in those crates. So we would have directing notes for the actors. And they were all instructed to read their own notes and not read each other's notes. So it would be like an instruction to Heather would be like, you know, you walk south all day long, don't take no for an answer, you know the way home. And then we'd tell Josh or Michael that sometime in the afternoon, you've had it, you're fed up, you better confront Heather. Now, each actor didn't know each other's note and that conflict was going to happen. We just left it to them to find the right moment in the day to have that conflict. So that's an example of us directing them, but allowing them to sort of come up with their own dialogue per the script, but make it their own. So we didn't know if it was going to work at the time that we did it, but it ended up working out. But that was our methodology to keep control of the narrative process while we observe them and review their tapes, but allow them kind of the freedom to kind of come up with their own dialogue.
And the thing about low budget filmmaking is everything still has to be done correctly. The cinematography has to be done perfectly. The acting has to be done perfectly. The directing has to be done perfectly. The great thing about Blair was that the perfect filmmaking was bad filmmaking. The perfect sound was bad sound because these are film students.
So how fluid then were some of the decisions on set as you followed them?
I mean, most of the waypoints were pretty much set because we had some fairly complicated gags. I mean, we needed them to see certain things like, you know, the first night they see the rocks in the tree. So we had all that set up ahead of time and they were instructed to go there. And then each night got progressively worse. And then, you know, the piles of rocks outside their tent, we had that sort of area mapped out for them. And then, of course, the shaking tent scene, which is sort of famous. But all that was sort of premeditated. And they were instructed to kind of run in a certain direction. And because we didn't want them getting hurt, you know, like running into a tree or something. So feeling like when, you know, the whole scene where Mike admits that he kicked the map in the scene, there was a big fight. Well, that was pretty much improvised.
Okay.
This is not why I brought you out here, man.
Okay.
I'm sorry about the map, man.
Okay.
What can I say?
Sorry. Please, just don't say sorry. The map was not worth to you. I knew exactly where we were on that map.
For you. I asked you.
I knew exactly where we were on that map.
To me. Yesterday, I asked you what river we were on.
You should have broken the stick your head.
Just camera off.
Give me the compass.
And then there's other things that were very much sort of, you know, by the book, which was like in the house in the end and the, like the shaking of the tent scene and stuff like that. So it's a little bit of a combination. And we were able, like I said, Ed and I, it's kind of strange, but Ed and I primarily were kind of observing the actors, you know, just a few feet away. We'd be hiding in the bushes, but we had to wear full camo, you know? I mean, because we had to hide in the bushes because we never knew where the camera was going to be. So we didn't want this awesome scene going on and there's he and I standing in the background in our windbreakers. That would have been, you know, we would have ruined the shot. So we had to be in camo observing them. So it was kind of like this military operation.
How did you kind of originally set up that plan of action of with just the idea of we need a cast who can act, react, and cue up your plan?
When they signed up for the audition, we had a paragraph for them reading that you're coming in for a parole hearing, you were convicted of murder 12 years ago, so state your case. And if they didn't come into the audition in character, we knew right away they didn't get it, right? So we were laying the groundwork really early on that this writing exercise was really stage setting. We were setting the stage for the characters, for the backstory, for this whole world we were building to allow three super talented actors to kind of stay to our narrative path, which is all writing, but allow the realism that improv brings to bear, that a documentary, if it's going to be played as real, you have to have that. So, and knowing, like I said, when not to direct, to resist that urge to step in and like tweak. I mean, one of the big things in the edit process for Ed and I was we had this huge pile of material we're looking at, all these great performances, and we didn't know where to start, honestly. With any actor, kind of director-producer relationship, there's an immense amount of trust. And I think the biggest thing for them, and even for us as writer-directors, was, you know, we're going to do this in a method, sort of unorthodox way, where the actors wouldn't know more than what their characters would know. So, like, Heather, for example, had a pretty good knowledge of what the Blair Witch mythology was all about and what her purpose was and what she was going out to do, where Michael and Josh, we kept them more in the dark about what this project was all about. But for the most part, they were all in. I mean, they were really committed and dedicated. And it's funny, you know, we've got lots of outtakes of the actors traipsing through the woods. And it's that moment that everything's tense. And then they stop and they hold up their GPS like, okay, where is this going? You know, it's completely out of character. And so it was 99% acting. I mean, it was just, they were just great actors doing their job as convincingly as possible. And they pulled it off in spades.
All right. So, wondering what has held so true about this kind of found footage documentary format for Blair Witch, but has maybe shifted later on in kind of the genre?
I mean, I think one of the things that we were trying to really stick to on our approach to our movie is that we always asked ourselves, why would the camera be running? It really is an important theoretical question to be asked because, you know, I've seen other attempts at found footage films and I see the camera rolling like, why is this camera going? They would have run for their lives, or this is an intimate moment between two individuals that there would not be some guy rolling on this. So you really have to ask yourself, why would the camera be rolling? And that was a constant question right at the tip of our tongues, both Ed and I. Like, we needed to justify that camera rolling. And part of it, that was back in the casting process. We needed to find a lead actor. And originally it was supposed to be three guys in the roles, but Heather Donahue came into my initial audition, and there was just something about her that felt like she was driven. And this combination is sort of like determination and drive and a little bit like almost like a pathology of wanting to prove herself, right? And so there's a point in the movie that you can see where Josh is like telling her, I can see why you're looking through this lens, because you can kind of keep the real world out.
I see why you like this video camera so much.
You do?
It's not quite reality.
Reality says we gotta move.
No, but it's totally like a filtered reality, man. It's like you can pretend everything's not quite the way it is.
So we wrote that moment in there just so we could continually explain to the audience, oh, I can see why they keep the camera going. And then over time, it becomes a movie about the Blair Witch Project. It transitions into this chronicling of their survival, right? So we were always asking ourselves that question and maintaining that the camera has to be on for a reason. and it has to be justifiable for the audience. And when you fail to do that, I think in modern found footage films, the audience knows it. They smell it. Even if they don't know exactly what the theory is behind it, it feels contrived that camera is on and it doesn't sell.
I actually even think it's two things. It's one, it can't feel contrived. But the second, I got really lucky and I got a chance to work with Akiva Goldsman, who wrote A Beautiful Mind. And he had just finished up Paranormal Activity. So it's just this random. It's not that he knew that I had anything to do with Blair Witch. And he was talking about they had this moment of the key unlocking to make that movie work. And it was that the story's being told from the editor's perspective. And so it's not contrived from the filmmaking perspective. This is natural footage. That's what it needs to look like. The second thing is the voice is the editor. So you're going to get specific, interesting moments because the editor's going to select those. So you have some
And that's the way most documentaries are, right? Yeah. The editor is directed in the edit.
Yeah, and so the editor's going to choose the most cinematic of what he has, but you need to make sure that what he has seems truthful.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. On Story is presented in part by Too Far Media, provocative stories for the eyes, ears, and imagination, by Rich Chaparro. Support for On Story comes from Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers, creating sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of the Bogle family values since 1968. This show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from SoundLab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.